Hello and welcome to Outside In. My name's John Burns and my guest today is a writer and a filmmaker who clearly has a fascination for the early pioneering days of mountaineering. A few years ago, I wrote and performed for my sins a play about George Mallory, and researching that, I became quite fascinated and amazed really by the kind of barriers that these men faced. So I'm delighted to have Mick Conifrey along with me today, and maybe we can chat about some of the things that he's written and his insights into those very early days of mountaineering. Hi Mick, how are you?
I'm good actually.
Great.
The English summer. the May showers.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's been, we've just had an extended winter here, basically. There's in Scotland, I think summer's been cancelled from what I can see. Yeah. How did you become interested in the pioneering mountaineers that you've written about?
Well, I was a documentary maker. A lot of people kind of assume that I was a climber who turned what I liked doing into work, but it was the other way around, really. I worked for the BBC for a long time, made films initially really about what they called in the BBC music and art, so a lot of kind of rock documentaries, architecture, that sort of stuff. And then I saw some photographs of an Arctic expedition from the turn of the century and got really intrigued by them. And I made a series for the BBC called Icemen, which was all about polar exploration. And then I kind of followed that up with a series called Mountain Men, which was all about the early expeditions. So I chucked away all my Paul Smith coats and swap them for raggedy old fleeces and much to the disgust of my wife. And since then, I haven't stopped wearing them.
Well, I mean, the Everest was known as the third pole, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it was. Yeah, I mean, you know, what interested me was this kind of era of what you might call trophy exploration, where people wanted to get to the furthest points of the globe, the highest points, you know, discover the source of the Nile. So it was all about trophies, really. And the supreme trophy when it came to mountaineering was to get to the summit of Everest. But early on, the principal problem was really access, because Everest is on the border of Tibet and Nepal. Both countries were closed to foreigners. And it was only really because of the power of the British Empire, really, that the British were able to get into Tibet. They couldn't get into Nepal until the 1950s, and were able to stage the first expedition. Lots of other climbers from other countries wanted to go there, but it just wasn't an option. They just didn't have the political clout, really.
So it was really about the empire. I mean, I think one of the things that we kind of lost something in a way, really, because the mountains, like, you know, you've written about Kanchenjunga and K2 and Everest. I mean, these were very much a little bit like moon exploration. The going to the summit of these places was perhaps people were going to places where nobody had ever been, and to altitudes that were unknown. I mean, how do you think that people began to learn about the challenges of altitude?
Well, you know, there were two things going on at the beginning of the 20th century. You know, one was the invention of aviation in its various forms, and the other was the sport of mountaineering. You know, both of them were concerned with that altitude. The early balloonists found to their costs the dangers of going to altitude, with several famous stories of people getting very sick or dying trying to make very rapid ascents. And when it came to mountaineering, it's, you know, it's kind of interesting because people didn't really understand it. And, you know, the that these days, every second article you read about Everest talks about going into the death zone. But really, they didn't understand. They didn't have that concept in the 1920s. They once Mont Blanc was climbed in the end of the 18th century, I suppose. People started to see that, you know, there were dangers of going to high altitude, that you could get altitude sickness on Mont Blanc, but they still didn't really get it. And so when they went to Everest on the first expedition in 1922, or the reconnaissance in 1921, they all really underestimated that altitude. They thought, oh, it's going to be a problem, but it's not going to be that severe a problem. They argued a lot about, sorry, I've got a bit of a ping. they argued a lot about whether they needed oxygen or not. But they didn't have that sort of concept, as I say, of the death zone, that this was a place where mankind cannot live, you know, where the clock is ticking. It just wasn't like that. And on the other hand, the dangers of altitude are very real, and people, as people have found out over the years.
Well, yeah, I mean, when I was researching Alistair Crowley and his early expeditions to K2 and Kanchenjunga, I understand Crowley's a very conflicted individual. As I'm sure you know, and he has some very great strengths. And he and at the time when the early expeditions were going, there seemed, as far as I'm aware, there were two sort of ideas or concepts about how high altitude could be tackled. There was people who felt that you went into high altitude for the least possible time and came down as fast because the body deteriorated. And Crowley's view was that you went up gradually so that you acclimatized. And what do you think about Crowley's early expeditions? Did he make a real contribution to mountaineering, or were they just sort of, I don't know, amateur adventures?
Crowley is, as you say, a very complicated guy. And, you know, for a long time, in a way, he was written out of the history of mountaineering, you know, seen as a bit of a freak. I mean, his other activities when it came to magic, his sex and drugs were, sorry, I'm pinging again.
it's okay, ping away.
You know, was seen as that was what Crowley was about. So nobody really thought of him as this kind of Himalayan pioneer. You know, whereas in fact the truth of the matter was that he went on the world's first expedition to K2 and was the climbing leader on the first expedition to Kanchenjunga.
Yes,
I would disagree with you though. Kind of, I mean, what's interesting about Crowley is that in a way he was very ahead of his time, because his idea.
Yes.
Was that you should rush the mountain, you know, that he thought, you know, he saw himself as being fast. There's a great quote from where he says that his climbing style could be considered barely human. And his idea was that you should try and do things quickly, you know. And so in the 1980s, late 70s, 80s, there was a style of kind of Himalayan climbing of Everest climbing called Himalayan style. You know, the 1950s and 60s were dominated by huge expeditions which took a long time very much went up these big mountains in stages. Then in the 70s and 80s, this younger generation of climbers, people like Messner and Stephen Venables, Andy Fanshawe, all those sort of people, said, no, we're not going to do it like that. We don't want to have big expeditions. We want to get in and out quickly. And there were some physiologists who thought that was a much better approach, you know, because the previous orthodoxy was that you had to gradually acclimatize. Mm-hmm. You kind of climbed higher, slept lower, climbed a bit higher, slept lower. So, you know, Crowley in a way was ahead of his time, you know, and he certainly put his money where his mouth was. And he was able to do that because he was very rich. He inherited a lot of money from his father, who made a lot, who from the family brewing business.
That's right.
And it was very expensive to go to the Himalayas at the beginning of the century. But Crowley at that point in his life had a lot of money. So he was able to go to K2 and go to Kanchenjunga. On the K2 expedition, he didn't really do very much.
No.
Because they were all so ill and with very, not with altitude sickness, but with influenza and various respiratory problems, which really laid them low. But on Kanchenjunga, they actually got quite high. And it was very much because Crowley was pushing people. You know, the argument at the time was he pushing people too hard? Was he taking too many risks? And in particular, was he taking too many risks with the porters, who were very ill-equipped? And in the end, it all went wrong. But interestingly, later on in the 1920s, Crowley continued to climb. He had a commune in Sicily, and he used to take his Bohemian pals into the mountains around this commune, and do some rock climbing. But when he also concocted a plan to climb Everest with a fellow Satanist friend from America, and the idea was that they were going to fly in and they were going to make a mad dash up the mountain, but it didn't happen. But he was also very critical of the. He was very much outside of the British establishment. So there was a terrible accident in 1922 on the first ever expedition, he was very critical, and he said this was all the fault of the people who wanted to rope the porters up, and it would have been much better if people had been hadn't been roped, and then there would have been many more survivors. There's a modern climber, his name, the tax man, Mick Fowler.
Yeah,
and he has repeated quite a few of Crowley's climbs on Beachy Head, and you know, talking about how difficult they were. He undoubtedly, the truth about Crowley was that he really loved climbing. He did it when he was youth. He climbed in Scotland, in the Lake District, in the Alps, went off to Mexico.
That's right.
And was very passionate about it. And it was the one sport that he excelled in. But by the 1920s, he'd lost all his money. He was very much an anti-establishment figure. He would never have been invited to go on one of the expeditions. It would have made it much more interesting, I suppose, if he had been. And that was that, really, you know.
Yeah, I mean, moving on to the 20s and the two early Everest expeditions, 1922, and obviously Mallory's expedition of 1924. What really struck me also was they were facing, I think, far greater challenges than exist today. I mean, as you know, Everest is queued up. Today, if you have enough money, you can pay people to take you to the top virtually. Those challenges have gone. I mean, I remember reading, I think, well, you'll know better than me, but I think it might have been on the 1922 expedition. Didn't somebody cough up part of his larynx at one point? I thought that was pretty horrific, really. Do you remember?
Go on. That was in 1924.
Was it 24? Right.
24, yeah. So, it was Howard Somerville. Fortunately, he was quite a famous doctor and surgeon. So when that happened, he'd been having terrible breathing problems. And when he did this, for most people, if they saw a pile of bleeding flesh on the snow, it would have been a terribly disconcerting moment. But because he was a medical man, he was able to cope with it, you know. I mean, you know, but then on the other hand, they got remarkably close to the top. I mean, Somerville coughed up the lining of his throat. He must have been at about, I don't know, 27,500 feet or, you know, very high.
Very, very high, yeah.
Stopped and allowed his partner, Norton, to carry on going. And Norton reached about 28,100 feet, you know, so this was on the second ever attempt, really. So, I mean, you know, they had big challenges in comparison to modern expeditions in some respects, but in other respects, they got remarkably close to the top, you know.
Yeah, incredible courage to do that. I mean, I felt one of the things that struck me was that a lot of those men had been through the First World War, and their attitude to risking their lives, I suppose they would have seen it as risking their lives for their country, but their attitude towards risking their lives and in a way, sacrifice, a willingness perhaps to sacrifice their own lives to achieve what they would have seen at the time as an incredible goal, was probably very different from our attitudes today. Do you think that's the case?
You know, to be quite honest, I would disagree with that. There's obviously a very famous, excellent book by Wade Davis.
Yes.
It's very much about looking at the war records of the people from Everest and the idea that their experience in the First World War informed their attitude to risk and to and also to kind of feeling that, you know, you had to live life to the full. I don't think that they weren't, you know, there. I think that there was always that, if you remember, if you go back earlier to the 1860s and the famous first ascent of the Matterhorn in Switzerland, when three English climbers and a very famous French guide died, there was a lot of press at this point about the dangers of mountaineering and why should they do this. And, you know, with those early Victorian climbers and tourists who went to the Alps, you know, deaths weren't commonplace, but they weren't infrequent, you know, to the point that Queen Victoria at one point actually talked to her prime minister about seeing whether there's something they could do to get climbing banned. So I think that from the beginning, from the Victorian stage, there was this sense that mountaineering was something dangerous, and but also that taking risks was part of the fun of it, was part of the enjoyment of it. Mm-hmm. And British climbers actually had a reputation for being safe, you know, for being not being reckless. And in the 1930s, certainly, there was a big fight between the British climbing establishment and the German and Italian climbers, who the Brits denounced as suicide climbers because they thought they were taking too many risks on going up the north faces of the Matterhorn and the Eiger. So when it came to Everest, you know, I mean, what you've got to remember is that if you look at the first two expeditions of the 1920s, 1922 and 24, they did turn back. They didn't keep on going. When in 1922, Norton and Mallory and Somerville were at about, I can't remember, 26,000 feet, they knew they could have gone further, but they decided to go back because there was one of their comrades, Moorshead, who was ill in his tent, and they thought, we've got to get him down to the North Col, and if we keep on going, we won't be able to do that. So they did turn back. And then similarly, George Finch, the Australian climber, who got further than Mallory and Norton, he got to about 27,500 feet, so the summit is about 1,500 feet away. He was in a situation where he thought, I can go on, but I don't think my climbing partner, Geoffrey Bruce, can, so I'm going to turn back. So they didn't take undue risks. I mean, and then in 1924, again, Norton and Somerville, they turned back. Norton turned back at 28,100 feet. So they weren't reckless with their lives, you know. And Mallory had always had a reputation of as being a bit of a risk taker. You know, in some senses, he was involved in both the accident in 1922 when an avalanche led to the deaths of several porters.
Yeah,
and obviously the disappearance in 1924. So I think that Mallory has a particular sort of, and not, it's not so much a question of risk, but I always thought he's a very determined character, And certainly he did sometimes in some of his writings, he would say things like, this is more akin to war than mountaineering. And,
yes.
And
yes,
the rhetoric
yes.
and the language of which came from the First World War. But in a way, he was exceptional. And the other climbers, you know, they didn't take undue risks. When Mallory and Irvin disappeared, you know, obviously they wanted to find their bodies, but they weren't willing to kind of throw themselves away when they could see this was unnecessarily dangerous. So, you know, I would say, coming back to this, that risk was always, and danger was always part of the process. And that the climbers in the 20s, I think they were sort of fairly typical. When Aleister Crowley went to Kanchenjunga, he had an argument with the Swiss climbers who were with him. And he said, look, we're in the Himalayas. It's more dangerous. We have to take more risks. And that was a line repeated by Ed Hillary in 1953 in his diary. Where he says, you know, we're on Everest now. We take bigger risks. But that was part of being a climber. Uh-huh. I'm not so sure. I've never been convinced that this was because of the experience in the First World War, because their behaviour to me didn't seem that different from the pioneers, Mummery and Crowley and
that's true.
You know, who had been in the Himalayas earlier. So that's the climbers who were involved in the first expeditions. Were soldiers in India. You know, Norton was a soldier in India. John Morris was a soldier in India. Jeff Bruce was a soldier in India. They were kind of, you know, it wasn't so much the First World War. They'd got experience of fighting in at the borders of the empire. You know, so again, it's not simply about the First World War, I don't think.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was also, you know, incredibly impressed by the hardships these guys endured, though. I mean, I felt that I mean, without the kind of modern equipment that we had, that we have today. But I don't know. Perhaps it's the case that mountaineering, by definition, is something that you have to endure those kind of hardships. Perhaps we're not that different. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that, you know, that I think the Victorians and the Edwardians were probably incredibly fit in a way that we sort of underestimate.
Yeah,
and I think that they were quite toughened. And so they put up with a lot, you know, and in a way that now we kind of say, oh, that's not good. Let's wrap ourselves up a little bit warmer. Or, you know, these were people who slept with their windows open at home. I don't know if Chris Bonington and Leo Holding and, you know, contemporary mountaineers sleep with their windows open. But I think they were toughened. And so there are, you know, obvious things like the sorts of clothing that they wore in some respects were very good. You know, tweed is a comeback. Very good Burberry windproof fabric is pretty good. But at the same time, you all know the problem with natural fibers is when they get wet.
When they get wet, yeah.
When they get sweaty, they don't work so well. So, and similarly, obviously, the oxygen equipment that they were using was very primitive by modern standards, very unpredictable, and went wrong a lot of the time. So a massive thing. I mean, the thing that destroyed so many of the Everest expeditions from the 1930s was terrible weather. You know,
they'd
just be snowed off the mountain. And whereas now, the ability to forecast a good weather window, we've seen it this year in terms of all the teams at Everest Base Camp, and they're all waiting for the weather window. They've got fantastic communications. They've got internet. Mm-hmm. They've got sat phones. They've got access to very good forecasting. And it does, like, as we all know, that forecasts are not always accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But that enables people to choose the best moment to climb in terms of the weather. And, you know, for all of these mountains, that the weather is such a significant part of it. That's such a big, what you might, objective challenge. And if you have If you have lots of snow, it's very avalanche prone. If you have lots of very high winds, it's very dangerous. If you have sudden terrible cold snaps, then it is again, it's a different form of danger. So I think the weather forecasting is probably one of the really key issues, particularly when it comes to Himalayan climbing, and that's something that they, you know, they just sort of had a bit of local knowledge, but that was about it.
Yeah, quite incredible. Your book on Kanchenjunga, that's available with a limited edition print. Is that correct?
Yes, I've done there's a charity that I've kind of raised money for over the years called African Mission.
Right.
Which works in Zimbabwe and in Uganda, and so I've got a special edition of my book, which has got an extra print, and I give some a fiver from the profits to African Mission. So yes.
Right. So what I'll do is I'll put a link to that book on the podcast website, so people can follow that. And I think you're currently working on a book. Is that right?
Yes, I'm currently doing a book about the first Everest expedition, which took place in 1922. Obviously, there was a reconnaissance a year earlier, so this year is the 100th anniversary of the reconnaissance expedition. But the first real attempt took place in 1922, and this is a book which is kind of very much doing what we've been talking about, really, which is going into detail about the nitty gritty of how they did it and the kind of personalities involved, but with throwing back and forward to the modern era and comparing what they endured to what the situation is now on Everest.
Right.
I think, you know, 100 years, obviously, it's a great point to take stock and to look at the differences and look at the similarities. You know, in some, there are similarities, as we said, you know, the clothing and equipment and lots of things are radically different. But there are other elements which are not so different, you know.
Yeah. I can't help thinking. Part of me feels that it's a great shame that these great beasts that towered over us all once have been slain. You know, we've been everywhere on our planet pretty much, apart from some of the deepest parts of the ocean, I guess. I don't know, part of the romantic idea that there should be places that remain a mystery is perhaps something that I adhere to. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, I think, you know, even in the 1920s, there were people writing that, the idea that there should be some bit of the earth which was kind of sacrosanct. But equally, they were also writing in the 1920s about space exploration. And so when the first Everest expedition was announced, there were articles in the press saying, well, what next? Well, it's obviously going to be Mars, isn't it? So I think that, when Everest was first climbed in 1953, there was a very famous British mountaineer called Eric Shipton, who really was a fantastic character, a fantastic traveler and mountaineer. And he had been known as Mr. Everest, and thought to, you know, always everybody assumed he was going to lead the first British expedition, but that didn't work out. But afterwards, he famously said that, you know, now that Everest is climbed, let's get on to the real climbing. And I think that what he meant was that the pleasure of climbing is not about, you know, bagging trophies, but it is fundamentally for him going to new places, doing things that have never been done before. And, you know, obviously he's what we've seen is that 100 or 50 years after he said that people still want to keep on going back to Everest, and there are probably, I don't know how many, but I'm sure that there are tens and maybe hundreds of mountains in the Himalayas which have never been climbed, and similarly in South America, in Patagonia, where you get some of the other kind of great ranges.
Yes, I'm sure.
There are still plenty of places which which haven't been ascended either because people think they're too big or too, you know, too small or, you know, or possibly too inaccessible. So, you know, I think that like most people, when you see the famous picture of the queue on the Lhotse face and the queues going up to the summit, taken a couple of years ago, you think, God, why would anybody want to do that? What is the pleasure of that? And also, isn't it dangerous enough without adding the danger
Yes, I would queue for it.
of queue for it? You know, what is, I mean, you know, when you, and the whole idea of going to these places which are sort of festooned by fixed ropes. I mean, the last bit of mountaineering I did, although some people probably wouldn't consider it mountaineering, was going up Chimborazo in Ecuador. And you know, we were really lucky. We went up on a day when there was nobody there. And even though this is quite a regularly climbed or ascended mountain and or volcano, and but that was the pleasure of it, was going to a place where there was nobody else, you know, and particularly if it was a beautiful place and it required a bit of strenuous activity to get there. And similarly, you know, that even when you go for a walk in the country, the joy of it is not when you see some, you know, fag paper or a sweet wrapper in front of you and some boot prints from the last person who's here. It's kind of when you get into a place and for a moment, you know, there's only you. That's the pleasure of it. So, you know, I'm not a mountaineer. I like walking and trekking and, you know, doing a little bit of mountaineering in sense of getting up stuff. But you know, definitely the remoteness, the inaccessibility, the feeling that you're in the middle of nowhere, away from the rest of civilization, it is very much part of the pleasure of it. And queuing doesn't really come into that, does it? You know.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think I still find a great deal of pleasure about being in the mountains, and I'm not doing anything for the first time these days. But I'm certainly, but there is a joy in being in a remote place. I'm reminded of there's the famous quote from Mallory. I think an American reporter asked him, "It's so dangerous climbing Everest. Why do it?" And I think Mallory almost just snapped at him because it's there. But actually, he went. What Mallory went on to say was that we climb for the sheer joy of it, and that, after all, is what life is for. And I think that quote, I think, probably sums up why people still go to mountains, really. Well, Mick, that was really fascinating. Thanks very much for talking to me. I'll put links to your books and your website, and very much look forward to your next book coming out, and maybe I could invite you back on the show to talk about that when that comes out.
Well, that'd be lovely.
Thanks very much, Mick. Pleasure talking to you.
All right then. Okay, cheerio.